Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, keeping up with the Joneses. But how rich are your neighbours? We look at disposable income levels in cities across Britain, plus where in the UK is the most miserable town? Do you live there? Also today, Bitcoin tops $100,000 for the first time. We explore how and what to buy, how to protect yourself, and ask if you can still make a fortune. And I've moved house with a wood burner. Can I start using it? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, how much spare cash do you have to spend? Money Supermarket's latest household money index has been released and shows we typically have £836 in disposable income each month. That is the amount of money you have basically left over to spend or save after taxes and bills have been paid. But as you might imagine, this varies significantly depending on where you live. So, Simon, firstly, what is the Household Money Index? How's it worked out? And why do you find this particularly interesting?
The Household Money Index is something that's produced by Money Supermarket, and it looks basically at what people's outgoings are, how much they're spending, you know, how much they've got coming in as well, and also at this concept of disposable income. Disposable income is something that gets talked about a lot, and it often gets defined in different ways. So the ONS talks about disposable income, for example, and disposable income is generally considered to be after tax and essential outgoings. Things like mortgage, rent, energy bills, that kind of thing. What I think is quite interesting about this Money Supermarket one is that they include 31 outgoings, right? So I'll run through the list here. Rent, mortgage, energy, water bills, broadband, stroke telephone, TV license, council tax, mobile phone contract, home or top-ups, home and contents insurance, phone insurance, car insurance, life insurance, health insurance, pet insurance, car finance, car leasing, vehicle fuel, travelling by public transport, school stroke childcare costs, pet costs, loan repayments, credit card repayments, contributing to private or workplace pensions, medications and healthcare products, home maintenance and repairs, groceries, toiletries, gym membership, streaming subscriptions, gaming, news subscriptions. Obviously, not everybody listening to this podcast is going to have every single one of those outgoings. I can tick a lot of those boxes, but I don't tick all of them. But they are all the things that, or they are all things, I should say, not all the things, they are all things that on a monthly basis, if you've got these expenses, these are the things you're having to pay out. You've got no choice about it. It's basically the cost of keeping the show on the road, right? Now, what I think is interesting is that the money you have over and above that, your disposable income, what you've got to spend on yourself and enjoying your life, or that you could divert into savings, for example, or investing, that I think is quite an interesting and accurate definition of how rich you feel. Because we hear talk about this all the time, don't we? We see those stories of like, I'm on a six-figure salary and I'm barely getting by. And everyone goes, what are you talking about? It's like, but my expenses are so high. It's always private school. It's always private school that gets people, isn't it? But people live to their means, and they also tend to live to their earnings. And what defines how rich they feel is how much they have to spend on themselves. You know, the things like, can I go out to dinner? Can I get a takeaway? Can I take the family out for the day? Is it like 10 days before payday and I'm looking at my bank balance going, how on earth am I going to limp through to when I get paid? That stuff, right? If you're making those decisions of going, well, actually, we can't go out for dinner, or we can't go do this with the family, or actually, do you know what? It's going to cost a fortune to do that. Or, oh, I've only got 10 days left. Or oh no, I've got 10 days left, more to the point, and how am I going to scrape through? That I think really impacts how you feel in terms of like, am I doing well? Am I doing badly? Do I have enough to save some money every month? And then am I having to go back to those savings and take a bit out of it to get through to payday? So that's why I think that this is actually a really quite interesting piece of research.
Lee, I just want to ask about the outgoings that Simon mentioned there, because there's a few that I sort of think gym memberships, fitness equipment, streaming subscriptions, gaming, and to a degree, news subscriptions, although I don't like saying that out loud, that you think that's not keeping the ship afloat, or whatever the wonderful expression Simon used, is it? That to me feels like that's money spent on enjoying yourself. Like my excess income would be spent on gaming and streaming.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that that could go into. Are you saying that that should go into what you're spending your disposable income on
On
rather
yourself, yeah,
than your
exactly,
essential goods?
rather than your essentials to keep things going.
Yeah, I understand that logic, but I guess they've become such a monthly outgoing for a lot of households that actually you have to factor them into to your monthly cost. For example, I think about going and watch football. I don't have a season ticket anymore, but I used to sort of think of that as a household expense. Yes, yeah, so it's not a necessity, but it's kind of something that enhances my life, and I started to see it as a bill rather than kind of frivolous spending. So I think that's what they're getting at
I see
here.
mine as charity, the Derby season ticket holder sort
Well,
of thing.
if you see
It's
yours as charity, I don't know
rather
why I'd call my Southend tickets. So,
Yeah, exactly.
so yeah, I kind of get it from that point. But Simon's right. This is really interesting. It's very comprehensive. I think having all of those kind of questions gives a real snapshot of where people, what people are spending on, and what we see as essential bills now. I mean, you might have even argued that something like broadband wasn't an essential bill 10 years ago. You know, these things are now getting clubbed in as a kind of item that is deemed as essential. So the two things I took away from this comprehensive piece of research that was incredibly interesting, first of all, is it feels like people, well, reading the research, people have more disposable income. So it was saying in September 2023, people across Britain were typically spending 70% of their monthly income on bills and outgoings. In September this year, it only fallen slightly to 69%. But the data that it has, the quarterly data, saying it is at now 62%. That's quite a sharp increase in the amount of disposable income that potentially people have every month. And then the kind of blow-by-blow city breakdown of this, because you might naturally go, well, London's rich, everyone in London's rich, everyone's must be making a packet there. And must be top of this list. But actually, London isn't top of this list for disposable income. It's actually fourth. Number one is Brighton. So this research is saying that the average disposable income in Brighton is £1,314. And actually, that rate of basically spending 45% of income on household bills is the lowest. At the other end of the spectrum here, Bristol was at the bottom of this, £430.73, and suggesting that almost 76% of income is spent on bills and outgoings. London is at 60% and has a disposable income of £1,013. Now, the reason why I think London probably is a little bit further down this list will be rental costs, you'd imagine. And if you do own a home, probably far higher mortgage rates than what you've been used to. But there was a couple of surprises in here. So just nudging ahead of London was Nottingham, £1,055, spending 48% of household income on their bills. And then Belfast was second, £1,104, and 49.4% spent on bills. So really interesting regional breakdown here. It suggests that the north-south divide isn't as bad as what you think when you've got, fifth Glasgow. In Glasgow, they have more disposable income than they do with their neighbours in Edinburgh, which might come as a surprise. So there was quite a lot in here that to sort of unpack and kind of take away, and I think that it shows the spread across the country.
Excellent. Simon, what picture do you think then it paints this sort of research?
I think it paints a picture where housing costs play a massive factor in it. So if you live in a city where rent or mortgage payments are likely to be lower due to property prices being lower, then that's going to make a very big difference. And I actually thought one of the interesting things about it is something that it doesn't pick up on, which is, for example, so it's going to include the cost of your commute in here. Now, if you're living in London, you're going to be paying a lot of money in rent or mortgage, but what you will be paying less on is potentially commuting costs because you're in London. So therefore, if you only have to use the London public transport network, which is A, comprehensive, and B, actually, in all reality, quite good value, then you're not going to be spending as much on commuting as somebody, for example, who lives outside of London coming into London. And so what I'd really like to see is this kind of expanded out to, towns and around the cities, and then compared to the cities. Are people saving money by living outside of the city and paying lower rent and mortgage, but having to pay those commute costs, or does it not work that way? And actually, that's going to very much depend, as we do with the whole property market thing, on really like localized areas. So if you happen to live in an expensive bit of the commuter belt and you're paying, a load of money every month to get into town to go to work, then your disposable income is going to come down by quite a lot. I mean, for example, it cost me about £500 a month to get to work. And I don't even, that's not even paying for a lot of the expenses that other people would pay for, because I cycle to the station at one end and then I cycle from the station to the office at the other end. So I don't pay for parking at the station, which lots of people do. That car park is full. And I'm just like, that is so expensive. I think it's something mad like £9 a day. I think £9 a day might be even be undercooking it. But like, if you're doing that every day of the week, that is so much money. And then obviously the tube fare at the other end. So things like that. And then once you start drilling down into it, you can see how people can shift their disposable income around by making decisions like, I'm going to walk or cycle to the station if I can, or I'm going to, do the other thing at the other end. And to go back to your point about, what's an essential or not, what's the keeping the show on the road stuff? Yeah, I mean, is a gym membership keeping the show on the road? The gaming keeping the show on the road? But you could argue that's kind of just like maintaining your basic standard of, like, not your basic standard of living, but like your kind of standard of existence of, like, you have to have a bit of like enjoyment as well as, just having your, nose to the
Have a nice
grindstone.
walk, Simon. Nice
You
walk in
could
the
do, but I
country.
think the gym membership one, I think a lot of people would consider essential. I think a lot of people might spend more money on gym memberships than they need to. But I think the gym membership one people would consider essential. And if you consider a streaming service essential, well, maybe if you don't watch TV, but instead you prefer to, game, then you would consider gaming as essential instead. But as I said, I think it does highlight, A, quite how much money we have to spend to keep the show on the road. And also that bit where, how there can be just those little changes that make a difference to how rich you feel.
Did you see the story this week that was doing the rounds on social media about the person that was earning £100,000 a year, and they were saying that they just don't feel that they're rich or kind of like have a standard of living in which £100,000 a year salary would kind of, warrant them. And there was obviously quite a lot of backlash and stuff. This, oh, poor you, only earning £100,000. But I actually think it's quite an interesting snapshot of, how you. £100,000, if you'd said to me 10, 15 years ago, earning that as a salary, that sounds huge. And it is a lot of money compared to the average. But depending on where you're living, all of these kind of costs do mount up. And I kind of understood it from a point of, there is a lot of waste. I think the people do things like potentially have too many takeaways and blah, blah, blah. But that's up to them how they spend their money if they've got the disposable income to do it. But I do kind of understand it. And I think it's all to do with, how much we're taxed and how much we're feeling squeezed, young professionals in that kind of, higher rate tax bracket, which a lot more of us are now higher rate taxpayers just because we're getting swept up into the net because the goalposts haven't moved and won't be moving for some time. And I think that there's going to be more of that kind of mood going on over the coming years.
I actually went on radio and did the maths on this subject as to whether 100,000 is considered a lot. And for, like, yes, caveat, caveat, it does seem a huge amount. But if you are living in London, you are the sole breadwinner, perhaps you're a single parent, you have three kids, you get to that 100,000. We know that 100,000, Simon, as you've mentioned before, is a big drop off for a lot of things, childcare, income tax, all sorts of things. Actually, you will not be feeling, I think, particularly particularly wealthy. And you know, some people, like I say, will get out the little violins. I've lived all over the country, so I know that where there it is cheaper and it's more expensive. But if you are in one of the more expensive areas down south and you have a lot of kids, I can say this as someone with no kids, I can understand that you would probably not feel the wealthiest.
Well, actually, I agree with you on that note. And I think 2 points, one of which, the second one is, which is something I was going to say just before you said that. But the first one, actually, off the back of what you said, is I think it makes a big, big difference as to where you are in the country. And I am pretty sure that somebody earning like 60 grand a year in Leeds or Manchester or Liverpool is probably going to feel richer than somebody earning 100 grand a year in London and the commuter belt, just because of the
really
difference
rich
in the cost
in
of
Yorkshire.
Living.
Yeah, wow. earning the same amount. I was like, because my rent went from 1,600 in London to 750 for a three-bedroom cottage right in the middle of Skipton. It was
and that
marvellous.
That makes a big difference. And also, as you said, it's like, it does depend. It's household income. It's not individual income as well. Because if you've got, you know, if you've got one high earner and one person who isn't working, you know, and like, we've ended up in the scenario now where it's just like totally expected. It's like, well, both partners have to work. And it's like, that's actually a massive generational shift, because my parents' generation, okay, both partners could choose to work and they did. I mean, you know, my mum's run her own business for 40 years, like kind of thing, but they didn't necessarily have to work. Okay. Whereas now it is have to work to pay the mortgage. Like, not even to just have a better standard of living. In many cases, it's just to pay the mortgage or just to pay the rent.
And
that's
in
many cases,
if you have a partner.
Some of those people are going out to work, and after they've paid all of the expenses of like childcare and everything like that, they're getting almost nothing back. So it's household income. So if you've got one partner who is earning, one partner who isn't earning, or one partner who is earning a lot and one partner who's earning a lower amount, then you're not going to feel as rich. If you've got two partners who are earning big money, then that's, you know, the household income where people suddenly start to have a lot of money. But then also, in order to do that, in many of those couples, and I know lots of people like that, they're then outsourcing so much of their life in order for both of them to be doing the high powered jobs that they earn lots of money, that their costs are absolutely ginormous. And so they then wander around on a, you know, two lots of like 80 grand a year or 100 grand a year, still complaining that they don't feel rich. And to go back to what I was going to say about the whole like feeling rich thing, is the thing that makes you feel richer is obviously your income going up, right? Because we anchor at the level that we're at. A, we're also always convinced that like the next person is earning more money than us, when often actually they aren't. It's just like, the reality is they aren't. They aren't earning as much as you think they are, and they're probably not earning that much more than you. I mean, there will be cases where they are, obviously. The other thing is like, it's getting that pay rise. But the more people that we pull into the higher rate tax band, Lee's point, the more people that we pull into that 60% tax bracket over £100,000, or losing, like if they're losing childcare, like the marginal tax rate is like off the charts kind of thing, going back to your point, the more of that pay rise they lose. And so they might get a kind of what feels like a decent pay rise, but then when you divide it up by like how much extra money it's going to be every month, and then you take half of it away, they're like, oh, basically I got what I thought was a good pay rise, and I'm just going to get £100 more a month. And then they look at all their outgoings and they go over the last year and they go, well, my outgoings have definitely gone up by more than £100 a month. So actually, I feel poorer than I did last year. And I think there's a genuine problem in the economy, you know, ever since the financial crisis, really, is that, you know, that we haven't really seen much of a rise in real wages. And then when you factor in the changes to the tax system, there is a huge amount more people paying 40% tax now, for example, and you're then losing nearly half of your pay rise. There's people who just don't feel like they're getting any richer every year, because they're just like, oh, it's like £70 a month. And like, well, oh, that's gone.
No, it's true. All right. Well, you may not live in the area with the highest level of disposable income, but be grateful that you don't live in Slough in Berkshire. It's been named by Rightmove as the most miserable town. But, well, let's be honest, they haven't been the first to be less than enamoured with Slough, come friendly bombs and all that jazz. Lee Boyce, What's wrong with Slough?
What's wrong with Slough, Georgie? I mean, this is a Rightmove piece of research, which actually was pitched to us and to all of our rivals as the happiest places to live in Britain. But of course, we decided to flip it on its head and do the most miserable places to live, just to be different.
Fair.
Could I just point out that was him, not me? I didn't do that. He did that. Okay,
And actually,
right.
can I just point out that it was actually Helen Crane who suggested to do it as the 10 most miserable places to live. And then when we got the list, and she went, "I've lived in quite a few of these," I thought, was fantastic. But
Poor Helen, she's not even here to defend herself.
no, she's not here to defend herself, but I promise. But no, I said that's good. Let's go against the grain. Let's go. Let's do the most miserable places to live. And I do think these things are a little bit unfair, right? So this is a Rightmove research. They've used the formula of asking in a survey numerous questions. Do you feel proud about the area you live in? Do you feel a sense of belonging? Can you be yourself? I earn enough to live comfortably in my area. It's got good public transport connections, so you can get out. Sports and recreational activities, community spirit, local services, doctors and schools. Generally, the people are friendly and polite. Nature and green spaces, employment opportunities, option to work from home, good restaurant shops, artistic and cultural activities, and living close to family or close friends, which I love. That was the end question, which I think sometimes divides a bit of opinion. Don't live too close to your parents and in-laws, but live close enough in case you need to lean on them for something. So that Slough was the top of the charts in this, and sounds not far away from London. It's got good commuter links. It's not far from Windsor, which is, one of the most popular tourist destinations in Britain. It's got lots of theme parks and things nearby. And actually, last weekend I was in Bracknell, so I wasn't a million miles away from Slough.
Rightly.
And actually, I was going around Bracknell town centre, and just like I do where I go basically anywhere in sort of those urban towns in Britain, I could have been anywhere. It had the same shops, it had the same kind of department store vibe, had a Fenix. It was just, I could have been basically been, it could have been anywhere. And I think that's maybe flipping it around to the happiest places to live. It's more the independent shops, the independent restaurants, all that kind of thing. So the number one place, happiest place, is Woodbridge in Suffolk, which again is, I've been to lots of independent places there. Number eight, Leigh-on Sea on the list. I'm not a million miles away from there. It has lots of independent shops, restaurants. People have a good lifestyle there, and that's what I think kind of flips this around. So I think it's unfair to sort of single out Slough and say, "Oh, it's a dump." And I think wherever you live, you and especially where you've grown up, I think you're always a bit down about it. You always kind of like poke a bit of fun at where you live. But I think fundamentally, you probably secretly love it. People get sort of upset about where they are. So Slough was top. I think what kind of helps cement it play its place top of this list is the average price of buying a home. So £411,820, average rent £1,824. That's quite a sizable amount of money to live in a town that potentially, hasn't got, the things that were ticking off those 15 questions that were in this list. The rest of the list, we've got Bradford second, Barking and Dagenham third, Dudley fourth, Croydon fifth, Walsall sixth, Brent seventh, Newham eighth, Bexley ninth, Birmingham 10th. But we'll have listeners in all these places, and they'll be going, "I'm
Yeah,
miserable."
I like this place. But I used to go to school in Croydon, but I've never lived in any of them. I've lived in or incredibly near to five out of the top 20 happiest. But I would add a few things to this list. So they've got Sevenoaks on here. I would add that they should ask things like, traffic's a nightmare. Traffic is a nightmare there. Winchester, there's a lot of homelessness, for example, there. Richmond, the average rent is over £3,000. This says I can earn enough to live comfortably in my area, but I wonder if your children could afford to live in that area, sort of question. Simon, what do you make of stories like this?
Do you remember Crap Towns? Anybody remember Crap Towns? This was
Was
something
it
that
a
was
show?
no, it was a kind of like an annual report that was put out, and I think they might have turned them into like little books, the kind of books you get, crap books you get for Christmas. It was like so the people behind the Idler magazine, and I remember that. So the first winner of the Crap Towns Award was Hull. And then the second one in 2004 was Luton. I was working in Luton at the time on the local newspaper, and there was, understandable uproar. We obviously ran it as a story. Can't remember whether we did that thing where you asterisk out some of the word crap so that people don't, you don't offend people, but obviously everybody knows what the word is. You don't want to asterisk out too much of that word because people might think of something else. Yeah, it divided the town. There was people in the town who were like, yeah, it's crap. And then there were people like, no, I take massive pride in Luton. It may not be like the shiniest, happiest, bestest place in the world, but it's my town, So it was quite interesting to see that. And I think people will always have good or bad things to say about everywhere. But I think it also doesn't necessarily reflect whether that place is wealthy or not. Because going back to Lee's point about, independent shops and restaurants and things like that. When I lived in North London, I lived in North Islington. So I didn't live in posh Islington. I lived in North Islington. I lived in a place called Stroud Green, which is between Finsbury Park and Crouch End, right? And it is officially one of the most deprived places in the country. It was also a great place to live. There was loads of independent shops, independent restaurants, independent cafes, independent businesses. There was a genuine, like, real mix of people. There was obviously concerns about gentrification, as there is literally everywhere. But the benefit of some of those people moving in there, many of whom had moved there because it was basically cheaper than the other nicer, theoretically nicer places nearby, was that there was some money there. There were some people with that disposable income that we were just talking about, and they could go spend it in those places. And so actually, for people who wanted to set up a business, it was a great place to set up a business. I knew a guy who set up a Turkish restaurant there. Petek, just after we moved in. Absolutely amazing restaurant. And I remember he doubled it in size a couple of years later. And he was really worried about knocking through into the shop next door because he was like, it's like, oh, I don't know if it'll kind of ruin the atmosphere and everything, but like, we're doing really well and I want to do it. And it's thriving, absolutely brilliant. And probably one of the best places you could set up a business like that kind of thing. So actually, some of these places are not necessarily directly correlated with there being lots of money. Some of them, on the other hand, definitely are.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, got a question here from a listener. I'm 35. Earn £32,000 and I pay 5% into my pension with my employer paying 3%, and there is no option to get increased employer contributions. I want to invest some extra money and I'm weighing up a stocks and shares ISA or a self-invested personal pension. What are the merits of each?
So one of the key merits that both stocks and shares, ISAs and SIPPs share is that the invested money will be in a tax-free environment, so sheltered from capital gains and dividend tax, and therefore giving it the best opportunity to compound and grow over time. But that's really where the similarities end, as they're two distinctly different products designed for different purposes. So the main merit of a SIPP is the tax relief you will gain on the contribution. So in this case, an additional 20% will be added to the money that you invest. Add this to the tax-free environment I just mentioned, and you can see why this is a really effective way of saving over the long term. The drawback here, though, is that you won't be able to access the money until 10 years before state retirement age, which continues to trickle up, and it'll be taxed as income when you withdraw it. This is then in contrast to the primary benefit of the stocks and shares ISA, which is the flexibility it gives you. So you can withdraw the funds as and when you need. If we think of a SIPP as saving for the long term, i.e., retirement, if you're saving for the short to medium term, then an ISA makes the most sense. There's also no tax to pay on the way out, unlike a pension. So ultimately, in this case, it depends on which objectives you prioritize, really. If it's retirement, then a SIPP is more beneficial. But if you think you'll want to access the money sooner, then an ISA makes sense.
And it's not an all or nothing affair, is it? You could potentially do both and split the savings between one and the other.
You could divide and conquer, do half and half, or just move it around, even on a month by month basis as your priorities change, or if you feel like one pot is looking like it's in need of a little boost, then yeah, you can continue to switch.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. It's done it. Bitcoin has topped $100,000 for the first time. So, have the crypto evangelists been proved right? Can you still make money from Bitcoin? And what other coins are worth looking into? Lee Boyce, Bitcoin tearing it up.
When you just said Bitcoin's done it, I kind of had like visions of it sort of like giving birth or something. It's done some sort of like, you know, like landmark thing, you know, wow. Yes, it did tick over $100,000 a coin. It's no longer over $100,000 a coin. It slipped back in Bitcoin-y ways to around about $98,000 a coin at the time of recording this podcast. And it has inevitably been a lot of excitement, a lot of kind of madness again. I think we discussed this on the podcast recently with all of the adverts I've started to notice again. I even had an email about NFTs this week, probably for the first time in God knows how long. The big reason for the rises in Bitcoin has been Donald Trump's election victory in the US. It soared basically because in his campaign he promised to make the US the crypto capital of the world. It was at $66,000 a coin before the election, and then a couple of weeks later it sort of, you know, was hitting above 90,000, broke the $100,000 barrier on the 5th of December. And that was off the back of Trump announcing that he would appoint pro-crypto Paul Atkins chairman of the US Finance Regulator, which is the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then Trump went on social media, told Bitcoin investors, you're welcome. And that absolutely triggered a price surge in Bitcoin that has been bubbling over. We've had lots of predictions. The latest prediction that we've got here from IG Markets is that this is likely to be a catalyst for another wave of momentum buying, taking it to about $105,000 a coin before $120,000 a coin in 2025. You know, there's lots of cryptocurrencies out there, thousands of them, you know, from meme coins to all the way up to the big one, which is Bitcoin. One of the reasons why Bitcoin prices have also been going up is that, you know, there is a restriction on how of the supply of them. There's something like 75% of it is thought to be held in long-term investors, long-term holders, which is limited supply. Of course, it brings that inevitable question of, should I buy Bitcoin? Should I get involved? Is it too late? All of that kind of questions that are going around. And it's a hard one to answer. I've got some skin in the game, very light skin in the game, I should add, like a whisper, like a whisk of hair in the game, in the overall Bitcoin game. And actually this week I logged into I used Coinbase, and I have done for around about, I'm going to say it's probably been about 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And actually, I hadn't filled out something that I needed to fill out in order to do some more trading or whatever if I wanted to, because I've just got money in Bitcoin that's just been sitting there and I haven't done anything with it. Interestingly, it made me do a quiz. And if I failed the quiz, my account would be locked for 24 hours and you'd have to take the quiz again. And you'd have to keep taking the quiz until you passed the test. Now, I took the quiz. It started off okay, first couple of questions. I've got a fairly strong knowledge on crypto, kind of, you know, I wouldn't say I'm an absolute expert, but I know the fundamentals and the basics. But then I got to the second half of the quiz and it was a lot of quite confusing questions about staking and all sorts of things. So I was like, actually, I do have a bit of a knowledge gap here. And I failed the quiz. I was like, oh, I'll be locked out. But actually, I had a second bite of the cherry, was allowed to do it a second time. I took a bit more time on it and I can say to you that I passed the second
time. Well done,
Lee. I passed. I felt good. It was
congratulations.
I felt quite under pressure. But what that taught me is that there is a lot more regulation over what people, you know, there were so many people that had their fingers burnt with kind of rises and falls in the past and with coins that have come and gone, whole FTX scandal, all of that kind of thing, that it feels like there's more controls. But then I kind of came away and said, but isn't that kind of not what the point of cryptocurrencies is? I thought there wasn't meant to really, you know, it's meant to be not like that. And then I went back in time and I thought about sort of 10 years ago or so, when it really started kicking off, when we first started writing about cryptocurrencies. And I remember my brother-in-law, and this feels like a fever dream, Georgie, it really does. My brother-in-law was like, you've got to get involved in Bitcoin, go buy some Bitcoin. I was like, yeah, yeah, okay, cool. I'll, you know, I'll give it a go. That's what we've got to do. And it shows you how more how mainstream it's become, because he was telling me about scanning his passport and sending it off to some Eastern European kind of like thing that I'd never heard of to verify him in order to. And I was like, nah, rule me out. This sounds mad.
Yeah, right?
he did manage to get some. And I believe it. He's still holding on to it. It was a wild
west. Why are
you
doing that?
Yeah. You definitely, you know, there's loads of places now that exist, platforms and things, where you can quite easily get involved. The other thing I noticed with Coinbase as well, that I had a quick look at Dogecoin. Just that I was not going to buy Dogecoin. I just wanted to sort of see what was going on with the price and whatnot. And it actually had a warning at the bottom about meme coins and about, you know, basically doing your research and finding out what these cryptocurrencies actually do and what they're kind of there to, you know, what problem are they solving? And something like a meme coin. We had a meme coin this week that was launched, and people got their fingers burnt, and then there was a rug pull and the money was gone. So you have to be really, really careful. And as we always say on this, you've got to do your research and find out what it is that it does and read about the blockchain and all of that kind of thing. Go off and do some research if you're interested. You know, it's like $100,000 a coin. That's the other thing. I went for a walk this morning. I was thinking about this, Georgie, the fact that it is volatile. We don't really use it to like buy and sell things, you know, other than a few sort of like hipster cafes or whatever that have accept Bitcoin. It's not like it's become a payment system that we're using on the regular. And what a lot of people feels like they're doing, they're just fear of missing out, putting cash into it, hoping it's going to sort of double and then exit. And again, I think I said this on the podcast recently, were we going to see it hit $100,000 and just a load of people exit? And I had my finger over the sell button. I was kind of tempted. And then I thought, you know, I don't have much in it. It's not, and it's kind of there. I'm there for the ride. It's like maybe 0.01% of my entire investment and savings portfolio. And then I thought, if I sold it, am I going to be a bit sad that I'm no longer sort of occasionally logging into my Coinbase and having a look at what it's doing? So that's where I'm at, Georgie.
Right, that's fairly, and I imagine that's probably a lot of people are at. But Simon, just listening to Lee there, persuade the non-evangelists, who are probably doing a little victory dance at the moment, but not the non-ones, the evangelists, that this is more than just gambling. Where's the value in this?
Well, I think you need to look at Bitcoin, then you need to look at the other main cryptos, and then you need to look at meme coins, and you need to look at all of them through a slightly different lens. So Bitcoin is the main crypto. Digital gold is the best way of describing Bitcoin. That's the way people think about it. It has become an asset class in itself, but it is hugely volatile. The swings in the price are immense, like way more than the swings in the price of gold, for example. It's highly dependent upon some of the factors that drive like high octane parts of the stock market, and actually has a tendency to move in lockstep with some of them. So there's quite a strong correlation between Bitcoin and things like Nvidia shares or something like that. The difference is Bitcoin doesn't make anything. It doesn't make any money, doesn't make any profits, doesn't, you know, pay out any dividends. But if you want to learn about the sort of ins and outs of arguing whether you should or you shouldn't invest in that kind of thing that you're just buying because theoretically it's worth something because someone says it's worth something, go and read what Warren Buffett has to say about gold. Now, the difference between Bitcoin and gold is gold's got a slightly longer track record. The Romans were not spending Bitcoin. Bitcoin was not around when Jesus was a lad. In another 2,000 years, you asked me this question some years back in one of the previous Bitcoin booms about, like, is it, you know, gold, digital gold? And I was like, well, I'll tell you what, ask me the question in 2,000 years and I'll tell you the answer. But that's like, it sounds flippant, but that, you know, that's a real thing. So whether you can compare it to make it the digital gold or not is another matter. What you do have is a large number of people holding it and holding on to it, and you do have a scenario where it's being opened up to institutional investors. We talked about this a few weeks back, just after the election. The ETFs make a big difference because what happens there is that there are now all kinds of investors who are either happy to hold Bitcoin through an ETF because the ETF is regulated and it feels more trustworthy than doing it through the exchanges or the platforms that you have to do it with, retail investors. But more importantly, there's big institutional investors who can now hold a bit of it. There are funds that can go, I'm going to hold a bit of Bitcoin. And they don't have to hold much for you to add together all of those funds. And in aggregate, that's quite a lot of demand. The question is, how much of that is already in the price? And the answer to that is a lot of it is already in the price. The price has obviously shifted up, you know, with Donald Trump. How much is that is pulling forward the future potential of Bitcoin? You know, it's what, up 40% or something since the election? I can't remember. You know, maybe 20% of that is justified, you could argue. Maybe 20% of it is pulling it forward. Maybe 5% of that is justified. 35% of it is pulling it forward. And what you've also got to remember is there's lots of people who've held it for a long time. And that 100,000 level has always been the, like, it's going to hit 100,000. It's going to hit 100,000. Going to hit 100,000. Everyone's like, it's never going to do that. It's never going to do that. Now it has hit that. There's lots of people who are like, well, do you know what? Even if they're long-time holders of Bitcoin, they're like, it's just as likely that it's going to tank by 40%. Keep going up, and maybe now I will take a bit of profit. I've got some Bitcoin, not a whole Bitcoin sadly, but I've got a chunk of Bitcoin, and I took some profits the other week, last week, before it went up through 100,000. It knocked on the door of 100,000, then it came down, and I thought to myself, there is every chance that this could take a tumble of 30% from here, and I wanted to make a bit of a capital gain, basically, so I could use some of my capital gains allowance this year with some of it. So I've still got a decent chunk of Bitcoin. We're talking like high five figures kind of number here. But I was like, I'm going to take some of this out, because if it sinks all the way back down to 60 or 50, I'll be kicking myself that I didn't take a bit of money out. And if it keeps going up, well, at least I've cashed in a bit of profit and I've still got some skin in the game. So that's Bitcoin. Then you've got the other main cryptos, right? So Ethereum, Cardano, Solana. Right, these are like the mainstream big cryptos, and there's ins and outs for why you should hold each of these ones. Ethereum was the big one. Everyone's like, Ethereum's the one. It's a platform. You need Ether to, like, essentially power the applications on the platform. That creates the demand for it. That's the one to hold. That's kind of shifted now, and the people in the know are saying, actually, no, Solana. Ethereum isn't as good as we thought. Solana's better. One of my best friends was telling me this in the pub the other day. But there you go. This is like exactly the kind of thing that people tend to act on with crypto, is their mate talking about it in the pub. My mate knows loads more about crypto than I do. And there comes a point where I kind of just stop trying to understand this stuff. He's telling me Solana is the one to go for. I'm like, I've got a little bit of Ethereum. I'm like, should it swap it for Solana? I don't know. I haven't done anything. But these are, you know, these are kind of respectable mainstream cryptos that each have their kind of, you know, use case or their idea for backing them behind it. Again, super volatile though, you know, way more volatile than investing in the stock market. And if you're going to put money into them, even if they may be respectable, even if they may be big, you've got to accept A, just work on the basis that there is a chance you could lose all of your money, or B, that you could suddenly lose 40%, 50% in a period of time that's so quick, you've got nothing, no opportunity to do anything about it. And then you've got the meme coins and the coins that have even like less reputation than the meme coins, you know, and these are just punting. These are just gambling. This is like sticking your money on a horse, or, you know, going down the dogs or whatever. I mean, some of these are for a huge amount. Dogecoin is up 412% over the past 12 months. But, you know, like, that's not investing. Any money you put in any of these meme coins, do not fool yourself and think that you are investing in them. You are just gambling. And gambling and investing are two very different things.
So, I mean, that's obviously one big tip. Go in with your eyes open, do your research. Is there other sort of playbook that you can follow to how to protect yourself if you do want to invest? Lee said about how his Bitcoin is, you know, such a fraction, tiny fraction of his entire portfolio. I suppose that's another little tip.
I wouldn't like let it be more than a few percent, or, you know, 5%, even if you wanted to be really brave, 10% of your total portfolio. And then obviously then need to keep an eye on it. If it's gone up a lot, it might be more than that. Now, it might be that you're just happy to go, okay, well, I'm not going to worry about that. And actually, I think of it as separate to my investment portfolio. I think of the bit of crypto that I've got as like, that's just like some fun stuff on the side. And if it goes up, it goes up. And if it goes down, it goes down. And what will be kind of thing. And then I've got my stocks and shares ISA over here. And then obviously my pension that I invest into. So I would almost, my personal view is think about it slightly differently. But if you're going to think about it as a whole, it needs to be only a small percent, because actually immense volatility in a relatively small percent can actually do quite serious damage to your overall investments and savings. Don't put money into it that you can't afford to lose, and invest through a reputable platform. You know, there are big name platforms out there that you can invest through. Obviously, Lee mentioned Coinbase. There's places like eToro. I mean, Kraken is one of them as well. But be careful about how you do this. You know, you can't buy the ETFs in the UK yet, unfortunately. I think it probably would be a good thing if you could do, even though it does expose people to a very volatile thing to invest in. But trust me, there are a lot of very volatile ETFs out there that you can invest in already. So I think probably we should be able to let people do it with the Bitcoin ones as well. And then also, like, there's a lot of fraud. There's so much fraud. You know, just, and anybody ever email weird story you see about celebrities made loads of money on crypto, phone call, any of that stuff, run a mile. It's a scammer. It's a fraudster. Don't even touch it.
Good advice there, Simon. Good advice. Right. It is reader question time. I'm looking at you there, Lee, in your toasty jumper and your looking quite cold shoffice. And I sort of thought of you because this is about wood stoves. I wouldn't like a wood stove where you are because I think the whole thing would burn down because it's proper all wood. But either way, so basically, you'll read a question time. I've recently bought a house with a wood stove and I'm keen to use it as the weather gets colder. I've never used one before. I don't want to fall foul of the various rules that I understand now regulate these stoves. I suspect mine is several decades old and may not meet modern standards. I live on the outskirts of Tunbridge in Kent. I know it well, and have access to endless free wood from a local farmer. Can I just burn this with no issues? Lee Boyce, what's the answer?
Well, wood burners, yeah, I definitely wouldn't have one in here, Georgie, blimey. You know, I'd have to knock it down and use it as the firewood. They're immensely popular. You know, people like to have them, especially this time of year, you know, feeling a bit Christmassy. I don't personally have one. I have no skin in this personal game, but I understand why they can be quite appealing. There is red tape around them. So, for example, any solid fuel stoves fitted from January 2022 need to meet government eco-design rules, which cap emissions. And in 2010, there were building regulations brought in, which were around fire safety rules. So how thick and wide these new ones needed to be. Now, of course, a lot of people have ones that predate either of these rules because, you know, a long time ago, it would have been sort of like a easy way to keep warm when we didn't all have central heating and all of that kind of thing. The rules that this particular person needs to stick to is whether or not you're in a smoke control zone. So some local councils have smoke control zones. A lot of urban areas are. This is to limit how much smoke is produced in an area. You've got to be careful. You need to be burning smokeless fuel. You can get fined if you get caught. Now, the full problems and why they're demonised a little bit is because there's actually research out this week from the Institute for Fiscal Studies saying that wood-burning stoves are now the UK's biggest source of an air pollution called PM2.5, small particulate pollution that gets into the air and that we breathe in. It is linked to the risk of respiratory and heart conditions. And in this report from the IFS saying an increasing number of hospital admissions, and it's really dangerous for children, for example, to breathe too much of this in. It's overtaken road transport and industrial processes as the number one emissions for PM2.5, according to this report. Three quarters of domestic combustion emissions of PM2.5 came from wood burning in 2022. So that shows you how much of the problem. This same report, actually, it was interesting for a couple of other reasons. In here it says councils have as I said, the ability to fine people. There was just one prosecution by a local authority in England in 2022, despite 10,600 complaints by residents. That was according to research from a pressure group called Mums for Lungs. There was another piece of information in here that was quite interesting. That piece of information is actually just how much pollution has dropped since 2003. It's down a huge amount of work has been done. It says here between 2003 and 2023, average levels of PM2.5 in England fell by 54%. That's pretty amazing. Now, we've got a 2022 study in here from Professor Chris Whitty. Remember him? Chief Medical Officer for England. Pandemic fame. And he said that even eco-designed stoves generated 450 times more toxic air pollution than gas central heating, while older stoves, now banned from sale, so those ones that predate all of this, produce 3,700 times more. So to go back to the original reader question, as long as you're playing by the rules, burning the right type of wood, you should not burn wood that has a high moisture content. The moisture content should be 20% below, preferably far below that. It's fine. But I tell you what, Georgie, and what my hunch is on this, I think they're going to get targeted. I'd be surprised if these aren't in the crosshairs. Having read that IFS report, having compared it to something like, the roads,
I didn't know they were that popular.
They are. Right. It depends on obviously the housing stock you're in. I'm in a relatively modern house. I'm in a mid-90s house, so of course it's just gas central heating. And even boilers are being demonized, George, aren't they? We've been kind of told to move on to heat pumps and other.
What about just an open fire in your living room or something?
Well, it's kind of the same thing. It's got to go somewhere, hasn't it? It's got to go out of a chimney and out into the air. I don't think you're going to suddenly...
Are they all going to be targeted? Are we not going to be able to burn anything?
Hey, look, I'm just going on...
Candles.
What I'm doing here is I'm doing the maths, Georgie. I'm putting wood-burning stoves are quite polluting, plus new Labour government with Ed Miliband quite obviously targeting, environmental kind of green issues. And then coming with an equals of, I think the days of these could be numbered, and I wouldn't be surprised to see more rules coming in. That's just a personal hunch.
Right.
Go ahead and use your wood burning stove at the moment within the rules of your local authority, burning the right type of wood and just playing by the rules. Are you going to get fined? Well, listen to that piece of information that I just told you there about how many people have been prosecuted. It doesn't seem that likely. But again, easily something that could get ramped up. Next year, let's target these people.
Yeah, who knows?
Let's put out more fines for this. You can see how it could all unfold.
All right, then. It is now podcast reader question time. And the winner of the This Is Money mug is Harry. Listening to this week's podcast, he says, funnily enough, was indeed painting the ceiling. My question from Harry. I started investing in the stock market in early 2024. I invest £250 each month equally between the FTSE 100, S&P 500 and an emerging markets ETF. I also invest in companies and index funds when I see an opportunity. My concern is that my investment in these other companies, normally £200 to £300, is too small to see a sizable return. I would invest more, but I'm in my late 20s, live alone and have all the normal bills to pay, so I don't have a great deal of cash left over at the end of the month. So, what would you say is a worthy amount to invest in a company as a one-off investment? Love the podcast. Thanks for all the laughs and learning. Simon, want to take this one?
Of course. Harry, thank you for emailing us. Well done for investing £250 a month as well. That is good going.
Yeah.
And also, sensible move, splitting it between the FTSE 100, S&P 500 and an emerging markets ETF. That's like you're solidly covering the bases. You're skewing yourself away from the global stock market. That's something you need to remember, is that the US makes up about 65% of the global stock market, whereas the FTSE all share, not just the FTSE 100, but the FTSE all share, just makes up 4% or something like that. But, you know, that's fine. It's fine to have a bit of home bias. And emerging markets are cheap. The UK is meant to be cheap. The US is meant to be expensive. You know, you're making a solid investment decision here. Investing in individual shares is a more risky endeavor. You need to understand that when you're investing in shares, is that you are putting much more of a stake into the fortune of one company. If you look at the academic research, they will recommend that you need to hold about, it's normally said 20 shares to have a diversified portfolio. But actually, if you look at some academic research, it could be about 14. But it needs to be companies that do different things and are affected by different things as well. So, for example, if you held a portfolio of 7 stocks, which were the Magnificent 7, that's not very diversified because they all tend to move in the same direction at the same time. They're almost an asset class as a whole. You'd have made a hell of a lot of money, but you're also opening yourself up to quite a lot of volatility. Now, it might feel that those shares that you've got are only a relatively small part of your portfolio, but actually they're an outsized chunk of your portfolio, probably, you know, held in just a number of companies. So that doesn't really matter. Now, the question is, like, how much should it be a worthy amount to invest in them? I'd say, like, so say, for example, you've got like a £3,000 portfolio. Well, you might think, okay, well, if I only put £300 into one of the companies, it's relatively small, but that is 10% of your portfolio in just one company. So that's a sizable amount. So what I'd maybe think of is the kind of like core and satellite approach. So you've got your core bit of your portfolio, which is the solid, sensible stuff, the ETFs that you're doing. The satellite is the kind of racier bit where you can invest in your individual stocks. And think of then that those individual stocks as like a pot of money in themselves, and then divide that up between those individual companies. And yes, it might mean that if one of those individual companies does spectacularly well, it doesn't send your whole portfolio up by 20%. But it also means if one of those companies suddenly comes a cropper and does badly, it won't sink the whole thing as well. And think about rebalancing, think about looking at it, and think about it through the kind of the lens of risk, rather than thinking about it through the whole, like, well, if it goes up 50%, my portfolio won't go up by a huge amount. And then also keep an eye on it as you go along, because it can quite easily end up with the scenario where you've grown a larger portfolio, and then you do have shareholdings in there that you hold on to for years because you're like, yeah, well, I still think that'd do well. But actually, it's now such a small percentage of your portfolio, maybe like 1% or less, that even if it did do spectacularly well, it would barely make a difference at all.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Simon. Well done, Harry. And finally, Simon's stat of the week.
Here is your stat of the week. Auto Trader. Probably don't need to explain what that is, but just for anybody who doesn't know, it's a car selling website, has made the bold claim that petrol cars on Britain's roads peaked this year. We have reached peak petrol car, and they are forecasting a seismic shift to electric vehicles from this point on. The peak for petrol cars on the road that they are calling is 18.7 million. 18.7 million petrol cars on Britain's roads this year. And they forecast that to decrease to just 11 million by 2034, a decline of 40%, obviously, as we shift to electric.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Simon. Thank you very much, Lee. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk and send us your questions, send us your podcast questions, and we will endeavour to pick out the best one, answer it, and send you a mug. And the mugs, I can now confirm, do exist. We have the mugs. The mugs are in our possession, and we will start sending out a mug a week to the winner of the question of the week. I have a mug. Lee has a mug.
Me too.
Georgie has a mug. And you two could have a This Is Money podcast mug, okay? Special 10th birthday celebration mug. Lee is threatening to individually number them, okay? Collector's items.
Ooh.
Threatening, I say. He hasn't numbered them yet. Anyway, so send us your questions, podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Put question in the subject line, please. You can do that thing that people do on social media. Is it tweeting? Is it Xing? It's not blue skying yet for us. We're only on X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, @thisismoney. And come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast. Find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.